being able to wear a spaghetti colander on your head is not something about the show. That's just in San Francisco.
That is true.
Well, that's from a segue into it. Just be like, oh, this is what I know about West Sam, Peck's show so far.
Hold on, where's that Twitter?
I gave it to you and you walked off with it.
Oh, here it is. Stamp Show Here Today podcast offers geeky fun for beginner and specialist collectors. Geeky fun.
That wasn't me. That was someone else.
You expected something different?
So it's Shire Rumsey?
Skylar.
Skylar? That does not look like what it's spelled as.
Yeah, spell it S-K-Y-L-E-R. That's how it's pronounced.
Oh, the one that I first saw, I thought was pronounced Shulier or something.
Third
thing. Yeah.
And that's actually his first name, Skylar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't get Brages from looking at your name either, so.
I spell your name 6 times.
I don't even. When I go to restaurants and they ask for a name, I always give next. So I'm the next party of 2 or the next party of 4.
Are you spaghetti?
Counter down.
Okay. Can you stop whistling?
That wasn't me that time.
Can everybody stop whistling? Jeff gets blamed for everything, by the way.
As you should blame him for everything.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you see, if my wife was here, she would blame me for everything. And I would blame her for everything.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes.
Okay. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm James Wygant of the Young Friends of the American Philatelic Society, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, podcast number 24. I'm sitting here with Scott, Kaz, Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps. So this week we'll be talking about stamps, news, West Pecks, stamp collecting history, West Pecks, stamp stories, Jerry Garcia, and our expert topic of the week is watermarks. So I'll start with stamp news. So far, the only thing I know about West Pecks is they do not joke around with hotel prices. And you are more than welcome to wear your spaghetti colander at your local DMV when you go to take your picture.
Yes, but you cannot tie your dog to a tree, or you can't buy any tamales in a bar. And if you fly in, San Francisco law says that the maximum a valet can charge is 50 cents to move your suitcase. That's a law from 1930. Save you some money.
So you better tell all those Prohibition-era tamale-selling valets that they need to get out.
That's it.
Only if they're located in a bar.
Well, this is true.
So this is the 55th annual show for West Pecks. It's going to be April 24 to 26th at the San Francisco Airport Marriott Waterfront Hotel. The address is 1800 Old Bayshore Highway, Burlingame, California, which is just about a mile south of the San Francisco International Airport.
And also is the place where tube socks were invented. A very, very small number of people realize that.
Burlingame?
Burlingame. Home of the tube sock.
Okay.
Dead silence.
I'm debating whether he made that up right now or if it's a real fact.
Oh, I know.
That's the problem with Kaz. It's that deadpan tone. You can't tell when he's joking.
So what have you guys seen in past shows that come to mind?
Well, it's usually pretty busy, especially on the first couple of days.
Friday is
just always busy.
That's where dealers do dealer business, and it's before the general public, you know, because normal people work on Fridays. It's only us weirdos who go up on Fridays to actually look at stamps.
Yeah, but there's always a crowd to get in.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to pay $5 It's $5 admission. I think it's for the whole weekend, though, right?
Mm-hmm. $5 admission, $50 parking. No, I don't know. Parking's a lot out there, so.
Actually, I think the parking's validated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with the show ticket.
So discounted parking or free parking?
I think it's free with the show parking, or with the show admission.
Oh, that's why it's packed. Everyone heard of free parking.
I know.
Well, no, parking $5 because you had to pay your admission.
There you go. So there's a big exhibition. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
World Series of Philately with 300 frames. That's a little more than I've ever seen. What was the last show like?
Well, the APS Riverside show had probably that many frames. Mm-hmm.
They tend to move them all around. So, you know, usually it's however many frames are available, that's how many you have, and they just move them from show to show to show.
Sometimes. Some, like in Sandical, the sponsoring group, actually owns the frames.
How many frames do they own?
I think when I was down there, they owned 250 frames.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a huge number.
But they never used them all.
Yeah.
So if you win an award here, you qualify for the Champion of Champions, it says?
Yes.
So everyone's trying to put their best foot forward at this show. It's not really for beginners, or it's already, like, vetted?
Well, no, at that point, you can enter it at any level. But the winner of the grand award winner for the show then goes on to compete at the summer APS show.
It sounds like it's directed more towards chicken stamp collectors than anything.
Oh yeah, I need to get my exhibit together. Absolutely. Which, by the way, totally off the subject, I found two non-cached chicken stamp covers on eBay.
Ooh.
The $50 one?
So they'll be cached quickly. No, they were like, one of them was in a group of five covers for like $1.50.
Huh.
Nice. So, I guess Skylar Rumsey Auctions is going to be part of the event. They're going to be there for 4 days. So I guess they're going to show up, what, Wednesday, Thursday?
Another note, Skylar Rumsey, who owns the auction, one of the inventors of the tube sock.
Now you have your answer, Jessica.
Something smells funny in here.
Great. He runs a great auction. Mostly, he does really well with postal history covers and the like.
But I mean, he has stuff from all over. But
he sold the DuPont collection.
Yeah, but part of it.
Well,
but
the important
part. He is more known for Western covers
than
anything else, I guess.
Yeah, there was one that had that little damaged magenta stamp. But the real major part of the DuPont collection went through Skylar Rumsey, the two huge boxes of postage.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so the theme this year is they're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Panama Pacific International Exposition. So what was the first one?
Well, the first one was in 1915, obviously. And they built a whole big fairgrounds. It was kind of like a World's Fair, and
the buildings are still there.
Yeah, some of the buildings are still there, and you can still find medals and coins and
lots of other labels and stickers.
Labels, stickers, covers. They advertised it for a couple of years before the show, and some of that stuff is very, very collectible.
They put out an issue of stamps.
Yes, our U.S. got numbers 397 to 404.
So if you have those, you can bring them in, put 49 cents worth on a cover, which would be a hell of a lot of catalog value.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it would.
Maybe not a good idea. They're saying they're going to be 75 national and international dealers.
Mm.
So that'll be fun. That's probably why we couldn't do the table. They have a 75 limit, and 76 is too many.
Well, you know, come to think about it, if you put one of each of those stamps on it, you'd only have 46 cents. And you couldn't nail a lot.
Well, I was just thinking you'd put, like, four 404s.
No.
A 403.
No, you put
two 402s.
You put one of each stamp from 397 to 404, and you would have 46 cents. You'd still need a 3 cent stamp, a chicken stamp, to mail your letter.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
There's a chicken cover.
Cash is just crazy enough to do that, too.
I don't think I would, actually.
How much of the catalog value of those be?
You don't think you can get some cheap
no-gum copies? I can't even get regular stamps through the post office. Another totally aside. Everybody,
right.
Jeff is laughing. I put, I got imperf Jimi Hendrix press sheet and an imperf Johnny Cash press sheet. I cut the stamps out, put them on envelopes, mailed out, I sell stuff on eBay, mailed out some eBay, and got like half of them back. Everybody saying, these are not stamps, this is not postage. I had to give the manager at our local post office a copy of the receipt of purchase from the stamp fulfillment house in St. Louis or
Kansas City,
whatever, from Kansas City, showing that I bought them and that they're real stamps, and I had to show them that they exist and everything, and finally they all went through. But two of them, those were just bundled up and said no, and I had to take them back. Two of them with Jimi Hendrix stamps, they actually pen canceled the stamps, and it says not postage, return to sender. And I sent copies of both of them to Mr. Snee at Lins and Stamp News, who, by the way, was also a co-inventor of the tube sock. And he hopefully will put those into the next Lins or whatever, because, you know, I understand what the post office is looking at. I mean, they kind of don't look like stamps, but they really are their stamps.
I can understand them not knowing, oh, okay, you've got, you know, 2 3-cent commemoratives on there. That's acceptable if they don't know what that is. But those are forever stamps.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Well, the other interesting thing is, you know, people buy errors from the post office. And, like, if you got an error and just stuck it on an envelope and it went through the mail, and then it would come back to you because they didn't recognize it as postage for some reason. That would be interesting. Like, you know, if the original C3A, somebody had put one on an envelope, and the post office sent it back saying, this is not a stamp, the airplane's upside down.
Okay, so this brings up an article, since we're talking about Westpex, by Sivas's Corner. It's a blog. I'll put a link up to our show notes. And he wrote an article called, Are Stamp Expos Necessary? So what do you guys have to say about, is it a good way to spend your time?
Well, is it necessary?
Well, considering how many stamps you can buy online,
I think
probably not. But, you know, they're absolutely necessary because most collectors, well, I mean, if you're going to spend more than, you know, 50 cents or a dollar on a stamp, you actually, most people want to hold the stamp in their hand before they decide whether they want to buy it or not. They want to see the condition, and that's kind of hard to do through a computer.
Well, I think that it's even more than that. Is the APS is a society. The ASDA is a dealer society. You know, we have all these societies. See, stamp collecting is social. It has a social aspect to it, and if you take away the expositions and the stamp shows, you remove that social value, and I think that would do significant damage to the collecting interest. I mean, people like talking to each other about stamps. Imagine
geeks and nerds like to hang out with other geeks and nerds.
Exactly, and talk about Star Wars and Star Trek. So I totally believe they are necessary.
Well, on the plus side, if you're buying something online and paying real money for it, you should insist that it has a certificate.
Yeah. I will tell you that, in my opinion, and this is going to be very controversial, so send all your hate mail to Scott Murphy at DSE. I don't think that the exhibits are really that necessary.
I think they are. I think they're very educational.
I think that there are so many better ways now to get education, and the exhibits that the judges, the way that the judging goes right now. It gets so deep into the weeds and so fly specky that it the exhibits that, you know, 25 years ago were incredibly entertaining, today are just mind-numbingly dull.
I agree with that. I think the exhibits are necessary, but I don't think that the judging is helpful.
Took the words out of my mouth.
It really takes away from what the exhibits could be. You always told me about the exhibit, the Match in Medicine exhibit, where you had all, you know, you showed the stamp, and then down below the stamp, you gave a little what product it was for, and then a little blurb about the company and what they were selling and all of that, and you got silver.
Yeah.
And then you took away the blurb, and you just talked about when it was used and what the product was, and they gave you a vermeil. And you got rid of it and says, here's the stamp, one of three known. And you got a gold on that one. And to me, the first one is absolutely the most educational, the most entertaining, and absolutely that should be the kind of exhibit we should aspire to. And some of the exhibits that we have now are, just, like you said, just so fly-specky because of the way the judging rules are that, yeah, it's great to see good, rare, great material. The material is interesting, but it's laid out a lot of times, and it's so restricted in what they show and how they present it that a lot of times people can't, there's no way to compete unless you have very deep pockets. In most cases, yes, I know you can win good awards with very cheap exhibits, but
chickens on stamps.
Yeah, but it has to be done absolutely to a T to their rules, and they won't like it, but they won't be able to take points off for it, and therefore you'll get a higher medal.
I think they know this because at the APS show in Riverside, when you walked in the room, right there they had the George Washington stamps, and then they had Hotchner's exhibit. And Hotchner had, I believe, 10 frames. It might have been 8 frames. Each frame had 16 pages. Each page had a stamp story on it. It was a one-page story. And if you didn't like one, the very next one to it, just read it, and it became enjoyable. It was incredible, and I guarantee you if he had put it up for judging, if it was there for judging, if it was not a non-competitive, it would have gotten a silver or a bronze. They would have said, you don't have direction. You know,
you don't tell a story.
You don't tell a story. You're all over the place. It's like, no, that's...
You don't have rarity.
Yeah, you don't... There was nothing rare in it, yeah.
That's another, you know, the judging has a criterion there for rarity. You have to have the most rare thing or a number of rare pieces in your exhibit. And why? Why can't you make an exhibit out of common material and tell a story with it and make it interesting? That's what exhibiting should be about.
Well, when we went to, what was it, Sescal, and they had the... Negro licenses.
Oh, yeah, the post-Civil War wedding licenses.
Yeah, and the guy was so upset that he got a bad award. What did he get, a bronze or a silver? One or the other.
Yeah.
And he was so upset, and his comment was, or his critique was, you didn't tell the judges how rare this stuff was. And it's like, you don't have to tell the judges how rare it is. They can see how neat it is. They can see what an interesting story it tells. And, you know, to say, oh, well, if we would have known that there were only 122 of these ever existing and you have 7 of them, then we would have given you... That's a BS thing. It's like, mm-hmm. Look at the exhibit. It's about people owning people and then allowing them to get pieces of paper that say they're married in a time frame that is just, like, really weird in the American economy. And you don't give it a good grade because you didn't know it was rare.
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Well, you know, 100 years ago, the exhibits basically consisted of your album pages.
Yeah, yeah.
That was where exhibiting started. It was exhibit what you collect.
I think it's limited right now. They need to kind of widen it to include digital media. Wouldn't it be great to get have a Twitter account for your exhibit or something like that, or be able to show pages of it and
I
stuff?
I do know that the APS offers all of the exhibitors at the APS-sponsored shows. They offer all exhibitors they solicit them to provide digital copies to the APS for posterity. So future generations can see the material digitally and learn and all of that. And they say less than 10% of exhibitors provide digital copies of their exhibits to the APS.
Well, and then on the other side...
Well, I understand sometimes they're changing.
I now have at my fingertips the ability to plate New Zealand number 6. And I don't collect any New Zealand. And I don't care what number 6 is, and I don't care to plate it. If you have crappy exhibits, it doesn't matter if they're digitized or not.
I understand, but I mean, we're talking about some of these really higher level exhibits, and the exhibitors refuse.
Oh,
well, it'd be great if they digitize them and make them searchable. Like if you're doing research on that topic for historical reasons,
I completely understand if your exhibit is going through changes because you're trying to get a better medal or to win a competition. I can understand not providing a copy of the exhibit in its current form. But when you decide to retire it or stop exhibiting, why not give a copy to the APS so that they have a final record of the end of the evolution of your exhibit, which would probably mean that it's the best it was ever going to get before, because you're retiring it.
Well, the other thing, too, is you'd have records of provenance on all this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And you'd have images of what exists. Because a lot of times, every year I see in different areas of the catalog, where a note will pop up. Catalog editors question the existence of this item and would like to see evidence of its current existence.
Yeah.
Well, because some of those items were placed in the catalog a
long time ago.
Yeah.
Long before VSCs and the like.
Long before tube socks.
Tube sock.
So this week in STEM collecting history, I'm just going to give you the website to go to find out the history of WestPex. It's www.westpex.org. www.westpex.org.
Boy, that was easy.
So, STEM stories. So, I've been watching 30 Rock reruns. I know what's that to do with stamps, but we'll get to that. And it inspired today's hashtag stampworthy. So, the script is, Liz, the Tina Fey character, says...
Who, by the way, was one of the co-inventors of Tube Sock.
Okay. We need to get these guys. Don't you know the Postmaster General? Then Jack, Alec Baldwin's character, says... I do, but we had a falling out over the Jerry Garcia stamp. If I want to look a hippie, I'd return Joan Baez's phone calls. So then I Googled Jerry Garcia stamp and actually came up with a Facebook page who is run by who I can only assume is a hippie named Steve Morris.
One of the co-inventors of Tube Socks.
And he mentioned the same quote. So his Facebook page is facebook.com/ Jerry Postage Stamp. So if you want to give a shout-out to him on Facebook or on Twitter, use the hashtag stampworthy, hashtag stampstories. Okay. Sorry. So updates. Casual corrections do you have for us today?
Well, first of all, I want to apologize. Last week, I told a joke that ended up not being funny. I thought it was hilarious. I want to apologize to everybody for having one of my jokes bomb.
That's okay. We feel the same way about your tube size joke, so you might as well apologize for that one now, too.
The second thing is... The second thing is we were speaking about the Spock his tragic death on, well, I guess not tragic, but his death on the 27th of last month.
Spock didn't die.
Excuse me, Leonard Nimoy's death. Canada has a $5 note that has a fellow on it that when you draw Spock hair on it, he looks exactly like Leonard Nimoy. And so I guess they're having a problem with people drawing Spock hair and little insignias on his collar. And so their $5 note is basically turning into a Spock $5 note. And I thought that was pull them up on the internet, take a look at some of the artwork these guys are doing. They look really, really good.
It's, I didn't know you didn't know about Spocking fives.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's called Spocking.
It's called Spocking.
Spocking?
Yeah.
Oh. It's been around for a while. But it just got really popular.
It's really popular.
It's Spock or what's the guy from Slytherin House in Harry Potter?
Snape.
Snape. They'll Snape him too.
Oh, I didn't see any snaping.
Okay, so I do have an update myself. My post-crossing postcard just reached its destination in Strelokna, Russia. It took 15 days and traveled 6,056 miles. So I'd like to give a shout-out to my pen pal, Ala, who received it and was very grateful. It's kind of neat.
Da, comrade.
Okay, so we received a listener question on our Facebook, and Jeff actually helped this person out, so I'm going to let him tell you guys what happened.
Okay, a woman named Maria from Riverside, California, contacted us on Facebook for help identifying a couple of stamps that she had. And she brought up some interesting points about proper stamp identification. So what she had was a red 2-cent Washington stamp from the Washington Franklin era, 1912, I think. And it was imperforate with Shermat coil perforations on the sides. And she was absolutely sure that she had a 482A, which is a rather expensive stamp. So she was asking me how you would better identify it, and I showed the picture to Scott, and Scott saw what type it was right away. The 482A is a type 1A. Scott said, no, it's a type 1, which made it a 409 with Shermat perforations instead. So I told her, and she was kind of upset. I guess a gentleman who has done stamp art for modern stamps in the last 10 or 15 years told her, yeah, that's a 482A. See, here's mine. It looks just like it. So we're exchanging weird looks and funny laughs in the office right now just because that's random. You know, I trust Maria's sincerity, but not necessarily the guy that she talked to.
Well, what are the odds of two people sitting next to each other, both of them winning the lottery?
Yeah, exactly. That was kind of a part of the point that I had made with this. So I talked her through. She'd never heard of types before, and she wasn't totally new to stamp collecting. I know she sounds rather new, not knowing of what types are specifically, but or that they even exist, but she said she was growing and she was trying to collect some knowledge, so she wanted to know why it had to be a 409 and not a 482A. So I showed her some.
First of all, Jeff, a note on types for people who don't know what types are. There are differences in the dies that were used to make the plates, and when they added or touched up the dies before making a new plate, sometimes this created noticeable constant differences on the new plate, and so they're designated as a different type, and they're collected. They're given a different Scott number, and they're collected as different stamps.
We have a worldwide audience. Same thing happens in Australia. Same thing happened in
many countries, especially on older era stamps, where they reused the same design over a number of years and made a lot of plates.
So, thank you. That was part of the thing I was trying to describe to her. So we talked about types a little bit, and I found some articles online. I told her, you know, when you have a question like this, Google can be a big help. Just Google search how to identify a 482A U.S. stamp. The top five hits, it took 20 minutes of reading, and you figure out exactly how to identify it.
And the number sixth hit was probably a porno site.
Probably.
Knowing Google.
Yeah. So I walked her through this, and she was really heartbroken because who wouldn't trust a guy that's drawn stamp art? He should know what he's talking about with stamps. And he said it was a 482A. So she was a little torn about that one.
Well, the another thing is, why wouldn't it be a 482, which is also type 1? The difference between 409 and 482 is a watermark.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can tell the likelihood of a certain issue based on the shade. And that particular stamp, I kind of got the feeling from the shade that it was probably a 409 and not a 482.
Okay. So, and that was the next question she had. Okay, well, if you can identify it by type, isn't the next step watermarking? So I told her, yeah, but to try to tell you in a text letter format how to look for a watermark is going to be really tough. I can tell you the process of doing it. We do it all the time. But knowing what you're looking for once a stamp is wet is next to impossible if you've never really seen it before. So to summarize with her, and don't take offense, this is, I consider this common sense, just realism. If you think you have a $100,000 stamp, you probably don't, and your chances are probably better at winning your local lottery, honestly.
Well, let me say a couple words about the Shermack Type 3 perforations as well. When you look in the catalog, there are three listings. Two of them are major numbers with the Shermack Type 3 perforations. It's the only way they come. 314A, which is an extremely rare stamp, and 482A, which is a moderately rare stamp.
Let's both back up just a
both
second.
Both of them have 5 or 6 figure prices.
We do have a worldwide audience, and half of our people who are listening right now are going, Shermack, is that one of those clovers that...
Shermack was a private mailing company that purchased imperforate stamps from the post office. They cut the sheets into strips and then applied their own private perforation in different shapes. The Type 3 happens to be an oblong, rectangular type.
And the reason they put their own perforations on it was...
And that was to help it be dispensed out of vending machines or...
Their own personal vending machines. Or
affixing machines.
Right. So it was like a high-speed stamp licker to put stamps on envelopes
for businesses. Right. Now, these perforations were applied to many different issues, but these two are the only ones that are listed in the normal postage section of the Scott catalog.
Mm-hmm.
There is a section in the back of the book that lists private vending and affixing machine perforations, and it goes through the different companies that did this and all the different types that each one produced, and then all the different stamps that those perforations can be found on. That's why when she looked in the catalog, all she saw was 482A, not realizing that it could be any of a number of identical looking issues.
If she had just happened to open her book to page 709, she would have seen that there are a bunch of others.
Actually,
it is on page 709.
Is it?
Yeah.
But I mean, somebody who just has a passing knowledge with stamp collecting may or may not own a specialized catalog. This is not going to be in the standard catalog. Oh,
good point, yeah.
So it does take a little bit more of a specialized knowledge to even know that that section exists. And that's why it can be very confusing and why we sometimes get these calls, because people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even in the book they're looking at.
Exactly. She even said that. She said, why don't they just say that? Why don't they say there are other variations thereof? It's in this book, in this section. And it would have saved her a lot of trouble.
But we still get... I don't know if it's a problem. I was going to say I think it's a problem, but we get a lot of number 114s without grill. And
114 is a 3-cent 1869
grilled stamp that
blue train stamp
pictorial issue, and there is a footnote now in there's a footnote in Scott that says that if it's unused, they can check it because, you know, is there grill marks on the gum and stuff. And if it's used, it says there was only one used ones. They lifted it off an envelope. They were able to see gum on the other side of the envelope and prove that it wasn't there. And they make a really big point that, you know, the used one is a very special case. We still get a whole bunch of people who submit 114s and say, hey, I don't see the grill. And we go, yeah, because it's probably pressed out or it was a light grill or something like that.
And I mean,
they don't read the catalogs in any case.
The catalog specifies that the list that particular listing is for original gum stamps only.
Yeah.
Now, you can have a used stamp with full original gum. That would be very rare. But it can happen. But a stamp unused with no gum or used with no gum, that listing is not for that.
Well, but the whole point is that people aren't, even though it says it there, they kind of just ignore what the catalog says and say, well, I want a $40,000 stamp.
They want to believe that they won the lottery.
Yeah.
And that's what I told her.
Which I don't fault them. I don't fault them at all.
Oh, no.
I told her that, too. I went on to explain that the only way I personally deal with whether or not I have an expensive stamp is I have to rule out every possibility of that design that it is not the cheap version.
Yeah.
I have to sit there and systematically go through. Because if you try to go backwards, and when you go first, you go, oh, look, I have that expensive stamp. You're going to do everything you can to prove that it's that stamp, but you're going to miss something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up in a situation like she's in. She was wondering if she should send her stamp in for certification. Well, no. Unfortunately.
I mean, you can, but you're not going to get, you know.
Well, you're going to pay more.
You're going to pay $30 for nothing.
You're going to pay $30 for a $15 stamp.
Yeah, exactly. So
or a $5 stamp.
I don't think it's a $15 stamp.
Yeah, you know, but no, it depends it's not. On couple it depends bucks. On which yeah. which one it is,
yeah.
but you know, it could be more, could be less, depending on which one it is.
So to end it, to quote Spock, since we were talking about him, if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So if you can rule out all of the cheap varieties, that's not it. You get closer to proving you might have something good.
Yep.
I thought that was Sherlock Holmes, not Spock.
Well, Spock might have been quoting Sherlock Holmes then, I'm not sure. But he did say it at some point.
As a matter of fact, I think I did hear it from...
Yeah, I know Spock said it.
Sherlock Holmes, though.
As soon as you brought that up, I remembered that, too. Yeah. So Spock quoted
and
Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes.
Saving Jeff from a correction.
Well, they're probably both quoting Aristotle, so...
Yeah.
Okay, so our expert topic of the week is watermarks. So you guys kind of defined what a watermark was.
Well, that's directly the same thing we've just been talking about. You know, the difference between expensive stamp and a really cheap stamp.
Well, I thought we talked about how a watermark was made. Did we talk about that last week?
No, mm-hmm. We didn't really go into any depth whatsoever.
I just start from scratch. So, yeah, keep going. Well, how are watermarks made? What are they?
I think we did, because watermarks are made when the paper is made. They take a pulp and they pass it through, lay it out on a screen, and as the water is drained off of the out of the pulp, they pass it through under a roll, and the watermark is usually adheres to the roller and basically causes a thin spot in a natural. An intentional thin area in the paper thickness, and so when it is dipped in water or when it is dipped in watermark fluid held to the light, you see a thinner area. When you dip it against a black background, it turns dark. When you hold it up against light, it turns light. More light shines through there. So a watermark is basically a design impressed into the paper in the papermaking process.
And there's three reasons why it occurs. First reason, it's just an imperfection. You see this with stitch watermarks. You see this with laid lines in the watermarks when the felt As the pulp is going over, it's usually on a layer of felt so that the felt leaches the water out. As the felt sort of disintegrates and goes away, the wires underneath it could show up through, and that's what a lot of times you'll see sort of ley lines.
Hmm. They don't use felt anymore.
Well, no, yeah, we're talking about 1880s. I mean, yeah. Today.
yeah.
So there's the watermarks that occur just through the water, the paper-making process. Then there's a second type of watermark where the person who makes the paper wants to identify themselves. So they will put their names in it or they will mark it in some way. And then the third way, the third thing that they do is to prevent counterfeiting. And so they'll print on security paper. And the way that if you get caught with these stamps, they hold them up to the light and they say, hey, this doesn't have a watermark on it. This is fake.
Oh, okay.
Now, so those are the three types of watermarks that occur.
Now, no, those are three reasons. Now,
there are three reasons.
Now, modern watermarks are not necessarily always made the same way. If you hold up a $100 bill and you'll see a watermark of Ben Franklin, that's actually an applied watermark where they actually have it's almost like a decal, and it's very densely pressed material and it's applied into the paper to create that design, and that's how they create the watermark on the $100 on the
currency,
all the U.S. currency now.
That's a good distinction too.
Yeah,
but people get confused by that.
But it's a different method. It's not the method that we're talking about.
So, what supplies do you recommend to someone trying to see a watermark on a stamp?
Well, first of all, I'd recommend a black tray of some sort, generally small, a little bit larger than stamp size. But not too large. You don't want to use too much fluid. A lot of times the fluid that is sold for watermarking or is used for watermarking is either it's either a chemical and it's not good to breathe in, or it's expensive and you don't want to use too much of it.
Yeah, that's
so.
People normally, what you get is you get a watermark tray, you fill it up with watermark fluid, and then you dip your stamps in. It's terribly inefficient because you're evaporating away a bunch of watermark fluid. The watermark fluid that they use, generally speaking, when you buy watermark fluid, is benzene solution, which is really not good for you. So you're filling a tray with water or with benzene and then trying to do as many stamps as you can
before it all evaporates.
That's funny.
The way that we do it is different. First of all, we don't use benzene. We use Ronzonol lighter fluid, which is naphtha.
And dirt cheap.
It's very inexpensive. But you do have to be careful because some inks, just like some inks are fugitive in water, some inks will also be affected by the lighter fluid. So you have to know whether your stamp is going to be affected by it before you try and dip a stamp, because you don't want to ruin your expensive stamps.
Right. Well, U.S., you don't have that much of a problem.
It's the modern.
Modern cancels, too, right?
Yeah, the cancels would.
The modern inks and some of the modern cancels may run in that. But
well, if you're looking for a watermark on a modern stamp.
Modern U.S. stamps do not have watermarks.
They stopped putting water. They discontinued, except for the IRS, for tax stamps, because again, they wanted to make sure people didn't steal $50 in a revenue stamp.
For postage stamps, it was prior to 1920.
Yeah. And I can't really think of very many. I mean, Britain used them up to the 1950s, so did Mexico.
Oh, Britain used them after that.
They did, okay.
Into the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Some of the U.S. wrappers used them later than that, too, didn't they? Some of the airmails?
No, 1915, 1918 was, I think, the last one. Yeah, they'd have very large watermarks.
Pretty ones, too.
Yeah. So anyway, a black tray. I recommend glass, black glass if you can get it.
Well, we don't even use trays, though.
But black plastic if you can't.
Yeah.
They're generally sold very inexpensively. We use just black approval cards with just a few drops of fluid on the card so that it doesn't splash all over the place. It does two things. One, it helps you not to use too much, and two, you don't end up breathing a whole lot of it.
Well, the other thing, too, is we only do, like, one stamp.
Yeah, we're only doing one stamp at a time.
So you put one stamp on, you throw a couple drops of lighter fluid on it, which, by the way, we suggest Ronzonol lighter fluid because it tends not to have... There are two things they add to lighter fluid. One of them is a scent to make it smell good, and the other one is a oil to make it not evaporate as fast. Well, you want it to evaporate as fast, and you don't want any scenting because who knows what that does to the stamps.
That's another chemical you're adding to your stamp.
Right, exactly.
Ronzonol does have different various plants in different countries that manufacture that, and we don't recommend that the product that comes out of the UK, we don't recommend that.
That's good to know.
There's whatever they put in it that's
or
different.
Or out of San Francisco.
Whatever that's different fascist. Than the product that they make in the United States, they have a slight difference in formula, and it is... more problem with inks with the UK formulation than with the US formula.
Yellow plastic bottle.
Yes,
yellow. That's what we use. Yellow plastic bottle Ronzonol.
And the funny thing is, it's getting very difficult to find. Walgreens doesn't carry any tobacco products, so they don't carry it. Long's Drugs, where I used to get mine, doesn't.
Actually, I bought two bottles at Walgreens last week.
You did?
I did.
Oh, my Walgreens doesn't have anything. It doesn't have cigarettes or anything. And I went to Home Depot. They only had some big, huge white lighter fluid bottle for your barbecue, Kingsford, and I have no clue what's in that, so I didn't use it.
No, the Walgreens didn't have any cigarettes or anything like that, but they did have lighter fluid.
Oh, really?
Okay. I've found luck with smoke shops. Not every smoke shop, but there's enough that have it.
Yeah.
So... You're going to be looking weird going in there just to buy six bottles of Ronzonol fluid and nothing else, but hey, it gets the job done.
Yeah.
And detecting watermarks is it either is very important or just very interesting. Like I collect early India, and you can plate the stamps because they used a full sheet watermark with nice bar border, and then the center of it is the seal, and it has all this great detail to it. So if you can figure out what part of the watermark the stamp has, you know what position it came from.
Cool.
And so you plate the stamps that way. In U.S., we have two varieties. We have the USIR, which is really cool.
Well, we have USPS for United States Postal Service.
Those are just normal.
No, there's but two kinds of those.
There's
too.
Two kinds. Yeah. There's a double line and there's a single line, and the size of the letters are different, and the way they look are different.
Look it up in a Scott catalog or online, because it gets really hard to tell.
Yep.
You can see it pretty on a nice full sheet picture what they look like what's in the Scott catalog. Once you start getting individual stamps, though, not so much.
Yeah, sometimes it can be very difficult.
Well, I like official seals because they use watermarks like. Early India, I guess, but they have these big, huge, flowing watermarks and eagles and stuff like that. Because again, it wasn't for security, because nobody literally cared how they were printed. They just wanted to get them done quick. They weren't meant to be anything. And you have these great paper maker companies making these really elaborate watermarks, and you can put them all together. It's pretty neat.
Some of the most prolific watermark countries is like Third Reich, Germany, anything?
Oh, yeah. Germany went nuts with them leading up to the war. Yeah. It always creeps people out. I collect World War I to World War II era Germany stamps. And I always tell people, hey, check this out. And I drop a Third Reich stamp into water fluid and hold it up. Look! It's covered in swastikas. And they just go...
one of the reasons why... One of the reasons I don't collect Argentina or Brazil is basically the watermarks. They're a lot of times difficult to tell the difference between the watermarks.
Oh, 1960s Mexico. It's incredible. They're so light that half the time you can't figure out what they are. I mean, we have a VSC machine, which is like state of the art for detecting watermarks, and you still can't figure out what the watermark is sometimes.
Sometimes.
If it gets off center, and now you have the end of one part of the watermark pinning on this side of the stamp and the gap and then the beginning of the next one. I think that's a little bit of the stick of the S over here, and that dark spot might be part of a U.
Well, the cool thing that I like is British colonies. You have a Crown CA or Crown CC, and it's either Crown Colonies or Crown Agents. And if you find the CAs, they tend to be more valuable, and the CCs tend not to be, so you flip everything up to the light, and you can get some good finds there.
So what other instances do you think where the watermark adds value?
I don't think it ever adds value. It just differentiates stamps. Sometimes you'll have rare stamps with rare watermarks, and sometimes you'll have rare stamps with no watermark.
Yeah, we have a lot of times you'll have identical looking stamps, and the only difference is the watermark. And that can make a difference in the value of the stamp, because one watermark was rarer on that particular issue.
Oh, with one exception. The USIR watermark on any normal postage stamp in the United States.
Right.
That can add some value. Right?
That's an interesting one, because
how many are there?
Only two letters matter.
That's right, the I and the R. If you have a U or an S, you can't tell. There's no way to tell.
So explain what happened.
I's are difficult to tell. You have to have quite a bit of the letter, or you have to have part of the next letter, and you have to look at the spacing of the letters and all of that to figure it out.
But we've seen some great 8-cent 1859 stamps where it just has a smack stab center R, a beautiful R. And you go, well, that's what it is.
So what happened? How'd those come about?
Oh, they just used revenue paper, got mixed in somehow or something like that.
Accidentally printed stamps on some revenue paper?
Yeah. Well, because revenue stamps, you need to make sure nobody steals. They're not ripping off 3 cents. They're ripping off $50, $100. Oh, yeah. You know, you have $500, $1,000 revenue stamps.
And that was 100 years ago, plus.
1940s. Yeah. 75 to 150 years ago, I guess. But the watermarks on those, you know, that was for heavy-duty security. And there's, what, 3 stamps that have USIR watermarks on them?
That is correct. 3 postage stamps.
Postage stamps, yeah.
There are plenty of revenue stamps with that watermark.
Okay, you guys ready to open a sheet?
Got holy it right sheet here.
Oh, Lord.
Drum roll.
Let's see, where is it?
I'm just hoping we're on the air. Gotta get ready to yell and scream. It is normal.
That stupid little red box is worth its weight in gold.
Okay, you can email us at stampshowtoday@gmail.com, Twitter, stampshowht, Facebook, stampshowtoday, and our website, www.stampshowtoday.com. With your questions and comments, you can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answering machine anytime. The number is country code 1-949-873-4298. There's also a link to a Google Voice on our website so you can make the call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
Hello, I am Sean.
I am Troy.
And this is Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
She wrote a bonnet, return to sender, address unknown.